just to recap real quickly, we are coming out of this chapter, and in the chapter we are dealing with the beginning of the situation that Job's in. And Satan shows up at a meeting. This is my paraphrase of the first chapter. Satan shows up at a meeting for the angels or the sons of man or whoever we wanted to determine that was. Well, when Satan shows up at that meeting, he shows up and God says, "What are you doing here?" in essence. And see, he says, I come from roaming the world. And God says, "If you consider my servant Job." He knows that if he had anyone to tempt or try, he wouldn't have been standing in front of him. Basically, he felt that, you know, Satan thought he had him licked, had him beat or whatever. So he says, "If you consider Job," Satan says, "Well, you know, he's kind of like the kid with the silver spoon in his mouth." And God says, "Do whatever you want, just don't touch him." And so Satan immediately leaves, goes, and he takes everything away. Takes all his material possessions, his animals, his livelihood, and his children. So he pretty well attacks his living, his livelihood, and his legacy. And then Job, what we studied last time was that Job stood up and he mourned, which was the tradition. And he mourned in the traditional way. He tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground in worship. And worshiped God and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will leave this life. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And then the last verse, I want to start there and kind of pick back up with that as we read into chapter 2. I'm going to read the first 10 verses there. It says, "Throughout all of this, Job did not sin or blame God for anything. One day the sons of God came again to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord asked Satan, 'Where have you come from?'" Now here we are again. Chapter 2 starts exactly like chapter 1. They're having a meeting. Satan feels like he's got God beat, and he showed up again. He says, from roaming through the earth, Satan answered him, walking around on it. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God, turns away from evil, and still retains his integrity, even though you incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason." "Skin for skin," Satan answered the Lord. "A man will give up everything he owns in exchange for his life. But stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." "Very well," the Lord told Satan, "he is in your power. Only spare his life." So Satan left the Lord's presence and infected Job with terrible boils from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery to scrape himself while he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." "You speak as a foolish woman speaks," he told her. "Should we accept only good from God and not adversity?" Throughout all of this, Job did not sin in what he said. I wanted to start with verse 22 because it is a reminder. It bookends this whole thing. He went through losing everything about him. Didn't sin. He in fact praised God and he didn't sin. And it brings us into chapter 2. And honestly, where we leave off chapter 1, you almost recognize Job is, he is almost, it's almost like he's on trial and he's been acquitted. And so the prosecutor's thrown everything at him. And at the end, it says he didn't sin and he didn't blame God for anything that happened. Well, if we go back to the things that happened to Job, every one of them, as we talked about, I guess it was two or three times ago, all of them were made to appear as acts of God, as something that God could have done to man or would have done to man. In fact, things that we probably see in Genesis and different places, all of these things are things that God brings upon men because of their sin. So Satan in himself is trying to blame God or get Job to blame God. But Satan had to leave to do anything he wanted. He had the clearance from God to do anything he wanted but touch Job. Well, as we get to chapter 2, that now has changed. The two chapters start exactly the same. One day the sons of God come together to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came to present himself also. That's how the story starts. That's how it begins again in chapter 2. And what you see here is that, in other words, Job has proved himself honest and a man of integrity. The interesting thing is that when you look back at chapter 1, what God says to him, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God, turns away from evil." We get to verse 3, it says, "If you consider my servant Job, no one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away evil." And then he adds a statement and says, "And he still retains his integrity, even though you incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason." So it goes from, it's almost like you could think you're reading the same account, and then all of a sudden you realize God's statement makes you realize this is the second time it's happened. The first time it happened, you see that Job was a man of integrity. Well, the second time God says the exact same words, but he adds in the statement, "even after you," and then goes to town again telling him how good Job is. But, you know, honestly, I would think Satan comes frustrated. It may be a different mindset when he comes before God this time of like, "I can't believe that didn't work." And Satan does not give up. When he wants to destroy someone, he will do everything he is allowed to do. Again, a reminder that God does not allow Satan to do anything. He doesn't think that the person can handle. I think that's completely obvious by the story here in Job. He had faith in Job. That's the way we ended the last time talking. He had faith in Job. So because he had faith in Job, we need to be aware that he probably has faith in us if we're facing trials and temptations and struggles. But truly, I don't know that anybody would have blamed Job had he cursed God or had he gotten upset. Again, talking about all the why God statements that we make and the different things. But there's a couple of things here that we're going to look at in this chapter. Satan goes in almost like he's trying to charge him with something else. If we're looking at it as a court case, this is the second time. It's like the state has found new evidence and now they want to present that and try to bring another, bring him down on a different charge or something. And the reality is that Satan has basically sworn himself to be the enemy of God. I mean, I truly believe that based on what Revelation says, based on what the scripture says, based on a number of different things, had Satan repented of his sin, God would have allowed him back in. I mean, God is a loving God who allows that repentance to take place. But he refused. He didn't want to. In fact, he made enemies with God to the point where God kicked him out of heaven and then turned him on his ear. And then here he is trying to take anyone he can with him. So what we see here is that Satan hated Job. Why did he hate Job? Was it anything Job did? No. It's because God loved him. Plain and simple. He hates Job because God loves Job. And so he wants to come in and he wants to tear him apart. He wants to do what he can. And he knows that God will say, "Have you considered my servant Job?" after the first time, I'm sure. Now, the first time might have caught him off guard, but this time I think he was, it's almost like, in a way, the way I look at these three verses, I almost see it in a way as God saying, obviously you didn't consider Job the first time, so let's try it again, because he's kind of throwing it at him and saying, "Have you considered my servant Job?" I mean, he hits him exactly the same way he did the first time, almost like, a parent would a child that's not listening. And I think it's almost ironic that he's doing it that way, because it's almost like he's rubbing it in his face saying, well, obviously, you know, I've got this servant out there who trusts me no matter what happens to him. And so this time he allows Satan the opportunity to touch him. This time he says, touch him, but don't kill him. You know, now we find out an interesting fact in these verses as well, though, that Job's wife still remains. So she's obviously not been taken from him. So he didn't lose everything, but he might as well have, because of her response to the whole situation anyway. But we'll get to that in a minute. But so here, if we look at it like a court case, like I was talking about, you've got the prosecutor or the accuser making the appearance before the judge. And the angels would have most likely seemed like a jury at this point. And he comes in and you almost think, well, maybe he's going to come in. You know, it's like, what are you doing here? Well, I'm here to confess that I have messed up, and you were right. Job is blameless. And he's like, no, I've got more. You know, it's kind of like every bit of evidence is for the defendant, and yet the prosecutor is still trying to turn everything just to find that one little piece that will change the entire case. I mean, it's like you get all the evidence laid out in a line, and there's not one single thing in it that can lean toward the prosecution, but he's saying there's got to be something. So he goes in, and the question is the same. Where do you come from? Now, does God need to know the answer to this question? No. He knows where he came from. He knows why he came from there. And he answers exactly the same way that he did the first time. So I was like, if I'm going to be frustrated, you're going to be frustrated. Where did you come from? Well, I came from going to and fro on the earth. Well, great. But that's what you said the first time. And I think that sparks God to just immediately continue the conversation exactly as it was done before. Saying, all right, well, if that's the answer you're going to give, then I'm going to ask you again, have you considered my servant Job? Knowing that he didn't, you know, forget Job the first time. But that's why I think he adds in that last part. It's almost like he gives Satan that little glimmer of hope, like, oh, you weren't paying attention. You didn't see that I went to Job. And then he said, but you've already tried to make it look like me. And he still blessed my name. He still called out to me. And the judge is saying, have you considered my servant Job? God is on Job's side. He has faith in Job. Even after this first set, he says the same thing. He is a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away from evil. And he even then adds that part that I was talking about, that he retains his integrity even though you incited me against him. Now, that statement, the King James says, thou movedest, big word, movedest me against him as an accuser to destroy him without cause. In other words, what God's saying is, I saw what you did. He's saying, I saw the way you attacked him. I saw the way that you went after him. And it was in vain. You tried to get him in ways that I would. You tried to make it look like I was the one. And, you know, Satan would be the great deceiver. That's what his job, that's the best title we can give him, is the great deceiver. And because of that, he's saying, God's saying to him, he's like, you know, you tried to make it look like it wasn't you. In other words, you tried to deceive Job. You tried to convince him that it was me, and yet he still didn't blame me for anything. He retained his integrity, even though you enticed me against him, or incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason. In other words, he made it look, and everybody else saw the things that were happening and immediately blamed God. They were saying, you know, why on earth would God be punishing Job and even his wife curse God and die? You know, I mean, when we get to that, that's the point that everybody else was seeing. They think God's involved in saying that God's killing Job or he's taking things from Job. You know, whatever you did, you've lived your life for God, and this is the thanks you're getting for it. And so he's kind of throwing that back at him, and then he commends Job for consistency. he commends Job for his consistency. And it's almost like God speaking in awe of Job. That, wow, he really, you know, it's not because I don't think God was surprised, but it's still, this is like what all of us would want. If, you know, this is the feeling of, now I'm not sure if Job's hearing the conversation that's taking place in heaven. No, don't get me wrong, I'm pretty sure he's not. Or else he would have been maybe a little more prepared, or it wouldn't have been a test or a trial that Satan could throw at him, because he knew, he would know that God's in control and what God's saying. But if you've ever tried to please your parents, I think it's a pretty good feeling when you hear your parents say they're proud of you. This is kind of what God is doing with Job. He's like that parent who's proud of a child, who's saying, you know, he's perfect. He's got everything. This is the child that I wanted to raise. This is the child that I prayed you would turn out to be. This is who I hoped you would be. You know, you've taken everything I could teach you, and you've turned it into perfection, so to speak. It doesn't mean that he's perfect. It just means that he's a man of integrity who has lived the best life that he possibly can. He's one of those that you never hear a bad word about. Everybody in town knows who he is and knows the situation. And probably everybody in town's completely shocked at why Job's going through all this. But it's like God speaks well of it. He speaks with wonder. He speaks with pleasure. And something of a triumph or a victory in his statement. Because he says he holds to his integrity. He holds fast to his integrity. He retains his integrity. Pretty much implying that, you know, you did everything you could to try to make it look like me, and yet he was a man of integrity and stood tall and recognized that it was not anything I did. And so then, you know, it's kind of like a trial. It becomes his praise. It becomes the honor for Job. And so then Satan responds. And it's almost like, what excuse do you think Satan can give at this point? Like, we get to verse 4, and Satan's reaching for straws. And he attacks back to God and says, skin for skin. Now, skin for skin, and all that a man has will he give for his life. In other words, if you allow me to get to Job to the brink of death, he will trade everything for one more breath. I know people like that. We all might be fighters. I mean, if you've ever faced anything that's even remotely been close to death, you would give it all just to be able to walk out of there again. I mean, when you see somebody with cancer on their last few moments before they finally give in, they'll fight. You see somebody going through difficult situations. I mean, there's this fight within people because of the fear of what comes next. And I believe that's Satan working in us to tell us, you know, the fear of what comes next is always the hardest part. But he's essentially saying, you know, if you allow him to have his flesh struck, if you allow me to attack him in his health, you know, take him to death's door, he will turn around. He will not follow you. He will not remain faithful. And I mean, honestly, life is sweet and precious. I mean, we all know that. We all know that life is precious. We talk about live every moment, you know, take it in. The themes that today's youth try to follow, the whole you only live once, and I don't like them, but that's what it's embracing, is the get the most out of your life, living my best life attitude. And the reality is that that's just part of who we are in some ways. But in Matthew 6:25, and I'm going to turn to that real quickly just read it. It says, therefore I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Isn't life more than food, and the body more than clothing? And when we look at that verse, you know, the comforts of life, there's something to it, because this is a teaching of Jesus where he's saying, isn't, you know, life more than food, and isn't your body more than clothing? In other words, the value on a body, the value on a life is more than the stuff around you. It's more than the material. And Satan is trying to use this idea against God and say, look, his life is going to be more important to him than all of this stuff if we just get a chance to touch his. You know, skin for skin is the way he words it. Which that statement in itself is kind of an odd statement, but there's really not it makes perfect sense when you hear it. Skin for skin. But Satan kind of stands there accusing Job and sort of saying, you know, as unnatural as, you know, as it is, he just laid 10 children to death or to rest, but that it died. He just lost all of his stuff. He lost everything. And he's had children die, servants die. He didn't care how many of them. You know, there's this whole thing about their bodies. He didn't preserve the body. He didn't take their bodies and save them for anything. I mean, it's, you know, it was their body, not his to own, type thing. But Satan's almost attacking Job, saying, look, God, he'll be selfish. If we attack Job, if you allow me to touch Job, Job will be selfish and he'll think only of Job, and he'll stop thinking about everything else. I mean, this is the same man who was putting, you know, animals on the altar for his children after every time they got together for their wild parties and whatever else, because they might have sinned. He was offering sacrifices on behalf of each individual child, not all the children as a whole. He was bringing men one at a time, offering sacrifices for cleansing. This is a man who had his focus on God. And it's almost like Satan's, in today's terms, like in the church, you know, somebody that lives this godly religious life. There's a lot of people that we look at and the first words the world says about them is, well, they're no fun. Well, they don't have anything. You know, they're boring. You know, and even when you're having a bad day and you talk to people, one of the first things that people like to tell you, well, you need to take care of you. And then they start offering you all these worldly suggestions as to how to get your mind off things. And the reality is 50% of them probably have to do with drugs and alcohol, or finding something that can, you know, and I mean, we're all guilty of thinking it at some point, probably, of how can we get out of this in a better way. Suicide is another thing that is part of this conversation, unfortunately. And that goes back into chapter 1, too. I mean, but what we're looking at here, there's the mentality in all of this that, you know, a man could really become distraught to the point where he really wants to just give it all up. And if we're looking back at it, I mean, Job stood up, tore his robe, shaved his head, and then he goes through this statement. But then you get into this statement here that the wife says, are you holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. I mean, she's more or less saying, kill yourself. You know, just get it over with in this suffering. This is ridiculous. You're dealing with too much. I mean, if we all took that mindset, that wouldn't be a good day, would it? But if it kind of relates back to Jonah in a way. I mean, where we went through Jonah on Sunday mornings, Jonah quite literally told God to take him out if he wasn't going to do what he wanted him to do. He said, it'd be better for me to be dead than to see this. And that's, you know, when we think about that mentality, when somebody gets to that point where they're willing to give up their own life just for, you know, because they just don't want to see anything else anymore, that brings you to a point where Satan truly has control. But the challenge given here to make further trial of it is Satan not only says skin for skin and tries to convince God to allow him to touch Job. Satan's next statement in verse 5 is, put forth thy hand. In other words, I can't touch him. Why don't you do it? I mean, it's almost like Satan saying, all right, well, the last time I made it look like you, he didn't buy it. How about you do this? You touch him. You go and do what needs to be done, because you're not leaving me anything to work with. I mean, he almost accuses God and places it in God's hands. He says he will curse you to your face and let go of his integrity, because Satan knew it. And by experience, we know it. And what I mean by that is that nothing is more likely to ruffle somebody's feathers than to them to go through their mind of pain, suffering, illness. When you find out you got cancer, when you find out that somebody's died, when you find out that you've got this illness that doctors don't know the answers to, the first things that happen are people get mad at God and they call out to God. We all know from experience. We all recognize it. And Paul himself had to bear a thorn in the flesh, he said, and he cried out to God 3 different times. Paul even said, I couldn't have done it without the grace of God. You know, he said, I called out 3 times to be healed, and God said, in your weakness, I'm made strong. My grace is sufficient for you. It's the grace of God that allows us to endure such heartaches and pains and sufferings. And so the permission was given to Satan, but God didn't answer Satan's request necessarily, it doesn't seem, because he says, very well, he is in your power, only spare his life. God's not reaching out his hand, but he's saying, go. Go do whatever you want to do to him, but leave it to me to stay here. I'm not touching him. I'm going to watch you do it. And so he leaves it that way. And then God didn't chain up the roaring lion, in essence. He didn't take Satan and put him in a cage and say, look, I'm not letting you do this anymore. You tested him. He passed. He said he's going to remain strong. God had faith in Job. And so what we see here is that Job is broken to the point. There's something in here in verse 8 that I think is really interesting. We call ourselves, you know, there's a lot of references about Christians being a jar of clay. Talking about the potter's hand making the jar of clay. You know, the whole story that we hear there. What does Job pick up but a broken piece of pottery, which he himself is? He uses a broken piece of pottery to scrape his wounds. And these are terrible wounds. I mean, he's got boils from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. I don't know what a boil looks like or feels like, but I'm sure it's not pleasant. You might. You're a medical person.
I think they're just blisters.
Like blisters or something?
Real big and nasty.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I want to know. Honestly, they sound painful. But Satan's tempted to let him go. You know, I think in this situation, if we relate back to Jesus, if we go back to the garden, when the serpent tempted Eve and then Adam, we see God's curse for the serpent was that man would, that he would bruise his heel and man would bruise his head. And then when Satan tempted Christ in the garden, he attempted to attack Christ at the core, at his adoption, in the wilderness, he attempted to attack Christ at his adoption. He was basically saying, you know, if thou beest the Son of God, if you are truly God's Son, then do this. You know, that little jab at trying to attack the integrity of Christ. So it's kind of a similar thing here. But he could not destroy him to death. He couldn't kill Job. All he could do and all he was given clearance to do was to make him sick. He could do anything he wanted. Satan had then, it says again, and I'm going to hurry through these three verses, but it says again that he left the Lord's presence and inflicted Job with terrible boils from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Job took a broken piece of pottery to scrape himself while he sat among the ashes. And so he tries to provoke him to curse God by bringing a sickness upon him. Could have even been leprosy at some, in some regard of it. Because when your body becomes open, boils lead to infection, lead to all kinds of things that can happen. This was a violent attack, but Job seems to keep his ground. I mean, he scrapes himself while he's set among the ashes, meaning he was still mourning over the loss of his children. I mean, he had barely even gotten out of that. And here he is, because it says he's still seated among the ashes, which leads you to believe that he's still suffering with that. But the disease that he was given was boils. And I have a word that I can't pronounce in my notes. Erysipelas, whatever that is. It's and it's like a inflammation, like an evil inflammation is what best definition I could find. But one boil, when it is gathering, is torment enough and gives a man abundance of pain and uneasiness. This is stuff I found on what boils are. And he had them all over him with nothing free. And it's almost like he was on fire. It's almost like his body was burning, possibly. Like he literally was boiling in his skin. It's like the devil just set him right in hell and turned it on. But he's going through this, and, you know, in all of this, he didn't deal with it in a bad way. And then you get into verse 8. Job took a broken piece of pottery, scraped himself, and sat among the ashes. He's sore. He's dealing with it. He's trying to figure out a way. And his children and servants were all dead. His wife is unkind. You'll see that in verse 9. And actually, if we go to Job 19, we'll see a lot of it. I can tell you that. We'll talk more about that later. He doesn't have a way of getting to a physician or a surgeon or anything else. He's literally sitting there dealing with this blistering, probably scraping himself, so he's got stuff oozing out of him. I can make it really gross if you want me to, but we don't have to.
No.
So he's going through all of this, and he sits down among the ashes, and he's just there and dealing with the pain, and he humbled himself under God's hand is in essence what he's doing with all of this. And there's different places within the scripture, in the book of Job or in Jonah, there where you talk about laying in dust and ashes. And then we get to the whole dust to dust, ashes to ashes conversation. We, you know, all of this kind of goes along with the story. But he then is urged by another source, and that's his wife, who tells him to curse God and die. And she asks him the question, are you still holding on to your integrity? This is a mean woman. This is not a nice statement. This is not something that, I mean, she can't believe he's actually saying that he's actually dealing with this in a godly manner. And God knew he would. But for her to ask the statement, do you still retain your integrity? This is almost similar to when Michael says to David, why are you dancing? This is stupid. You look dumb. The whole conversation that takes place when he's danced down the street half naked, and Michael looks at him and says, why are you doing this? And he says, I'll become even more undignified than this. Because it was all for praise of God. It had nothing to do with anything. He didn't care what people thought. He didn't care what they saw. And Job, I think, is in the same boat. Job doesn't care what everybody else thinks. Job has one audience, and it's one. It's God. He doesn't care what other people think or how they look at it. But she is implying, are you so stuck in religion? Are you so stuck in who you think you are that you are literally going to just sit here and deal with this and not say God's to blame? I mean, that's in essence the question she's asking. And it's almost like her questioning Job's integrity while asking him that question. She's questioning everything about him, saying, you're an idiot. I mean, it's she's just tearing him down, tearing him apart. And she's practically, I guess a better way to word it would be that she's saying, look, this is in vain. You shouldn't be doing this. Stop praying. Stop calling out to God. Stop all this. Curse God and die. And don't live in your dependence upon God. God obviously doesn't care about you. You've lost everything. Now you've lost your health. She's an angry woman who is seeing a loved one go through a multitude of pain, but she just lost everything too, pretty much. I mean, and now she's losing her husband. She's calling out and crying out in the way that everybody would expect Job almost to do it. And that's the interesting thing that kind of gets overlooked here. She's calling out to Job because she's about to lose him. And she's saying, curse God and die and let's just move on. She's losing her faith. But it's not about her faith. It's about his. And so Satan here, he's tempting. And then Job resists Satan. He gives her an answer. And he says, and this is where we're going to end it, but I know it's a little after, but he says, you speak as a foolish woman speaks. He says, should we accept only good from God and not adversity? Throughout all of this, Job did not sin in what he said. I find comfort in that. I hope you do. But this statement that he's making is almost like the statement Jesus made to Peter. When Peter was questioning him and said, why are you going? Don't go do this. You don't need to do this. You don't need to do that. And Jesus said what to him? Anybody want to take a wild stab? Get thee behind me, Satan. Because Peter was temptation to him. Peter was tempting him to not do what God had called him to do. And here you have the same situation. Job's wife's tempting Job to curse God and die. She's telling him, but she's tempting him. And this statement is almost like the get thee behind me Satan statement. He's saying, why would I curse God? He's saying, you speak as a foolish woman. He's not calling her names. He's simply telling her to hush and telling her that she does not have a place in this conversation right now. And if we continue through all that, I mean, there's other places where he reasons with his wife, even less harshly, while she's being harder to deal with on him. Job 19:17, I entreated her for the children's sake of my own body. It almost sounds like she's just hateful and doesn't like that he's religious anyway. Doesn't like that he gives everything to God, that he sacrifices the best animals. It almost sounds like as you go through the book of Job that she's not really where he is faithfully in her faith. But as we get through all this, he reasoned against it and said, shall we receive good at the hand of God and not also evil? In other words, he's saying, you know, if we're going to rejoice God in the good, we've got to rejoice him in the bad. We got to give God glory in all things because all things come from the God that we serve. He's being a spiritual leader. And he's saying to her, you know, the mercies we receive from God, both past and present, are never permanent because God's giving those out of the goodness of his heart. They're blessings for us and for this time. That's it. That's all we've got. And the last verse of this section, and then we get into the three friends, which is similar. conversation, but this is where we start getting into Job speaking and we get all the conversations that are taking place. But the last part of this verse, throughout all this, Job did not sin in what he said. It's the same thing we started with. It's the same thing we ended chapter 1 with. After the first day where he lost everything, he did not sin. And after this, he did not sin in anything he said. He did not curse God. He did not sin. He did not fall away from God in one bit at all. And that, I think, is where we find complete and utter respect for Job. But the reality is it's a reflection of his heart. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The abundance of Job's heart was pure and holy and just and following God. And that's something that Satan couldn't touch. That is his life. He was allowed to do anything but take his life. Well, his life was from the Lord. So therefore, he had nothing, but he had everything. He had all that he was promised, and that was another day of breath. And if his life had been taken, then that would have been the promise either, but he would have not, you know, it's kind of like the statement the old timers make anymore. It's like, well, I know where I'm going. Job knew what it was. He knew where he was. He knew his faith was strong, as did God. So, any questions? Have I raised any confusion?